You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, you might have heard of food deserts, areas lacking easy access to healthy, fresh food options. New studies say a bigger problem might be food swamps with too many unhealthy options within reach. First, the state legislature introduced a far-reaching bill aimed at landlords and tenants. According to sponsors, the proposal tries to make it easier and cheaper for landlords to do business in the state. But it has some groups worried, including advocates for domestic abuse victims. They're worried that the bill could put those victims at a risk of eviction. Chase Terrier is public policy coordinator for End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin. Chase, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
How could this bill make it easier to evict a victim of domestic abuse?
Well, there are a number of provisions in this bill that we in the domestic violence community are very concerned about. There's one in particular that I would point out, but before I get to that, I think we see this bill broadly as part of a pattern of legislation that we've seen over the last few sessions to slowly erode tenants' rights in favor of landlords' ability to sort of evict and with you know, more impunity and to do more of what they see fit at the expense of tenants' ability to stop those things from happening. The provision in this bill that we're particularly concerned about has to do with something called the Emergency Assistance Program. So this is a program that allows federal TANF dollars to be disseminated through the Department of Children and Families to families in times of crisis. So we're talking about low-income parents and children that are, various different reasons facing impending homelessness, whether it's natural disaster or in the case that we're talking about here, domestic violence. So if you're a domestic violence survivor and you are taking steps to leave an abuser, which as we know is the most dangerous time for victims, you may use these funds to get that sort of influx of cash to, you know, put down 1 month's deposit on a new apartment or something like that. Just a way to get out of the situation you're in and maintain some sort of stable housing. So the provision in this bill that we're really concerned about, it puts a limit on the ability of courts when someone is facing an eviction to say, you know what, we're going to stay these eviction proceedings. We're going to slow this process down because this person who's facing eviction has applied for emergency assistance. So we're going to make sure that filing is either, you know, confirmed or denied. But one way or the other, we want to make sure that this process is completed before they face eviction.
So how long, under the current system, before these changes, how long could that go on, that process?
Well, technically, it's supposed to take 5 days. And that's sort of the genesis of the provision in this bill. So this bill limits the stay on eviction proceedings to 5 days, which technically aligns with how long this process is supposed to take. However, we speak to advocates on the ground all the time who are working with victims, and what they tell us is, more often than not, this process is taking much, much longer than 5 days. So if we're going to limit the ability of courts to stay eviction proceedings to just 5 days, what you're basically doing is putting a lot of domestic violence victims directly in harm's way, because if they don't get that filing completed in 5 days, which they probably won't, they are suddenly back at risk of eviction through no fault of their own. You know, we're talking about people that have no access to finances. They've experienced financial abuse and control at the hands of their abuser. And so the idea that they should face eviction for actions that have, been foisted on them by their abusers is really troubling.
And Representative Rob Brooks, one of the sponsors of the bill, says he's willing to change that to go from the 5 day limit, the 5 day hold on evictions in these cases, up to 10 days. Is doubling the amount of days under it, is that enough time?
Yeah, so that's part of a sub-amendment that we were told was supposed to be out in the last couple of days. We still haven't seen it. It's a sprawling bill, as you mentioned, so we're hoping to see a lot of changes to this bill. And while I appreciate Representative Brooks's attempt there to make this better for domestic violence victims, whether it's 5 days or 10 days, the fact remains these applications are not going to go through in that period of time. We're talking about months in some cases for this emergency assistance application to go through. So the idea that we would go from 5 to 10 really is not helpful, and we still see this limiting of courts' ability to slow down evictions options for people in times of crisis as a huge problem.
Talking to Chase Terrier from End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin, looking at proposed changes to landlord-tenant regulations in Wisconsin. These are in the state legislature now, and concerns that this would hurt domestic abuse victims. Chase, you said that five-day limit was your main concern. What are some of your other concerns about this legislation as it relates to domestic abuse victims?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, in general, whenever we're talking about sort of the limiting of tenants' rights, we view that as something that is very concerning when it comes to domestic violence. Lack of access to housing is one of the top reasons that victims of domestic violence either stay with an abuser or return to a violent abuser. So anytime we see bills that are limiting tenants' rights, that's a big red flag for us. Another provision that was in the initial bill that we're hearing will hopefully change was requiring records for evictions to remain on CCAP for up to 10 years. We know that victims oftentimes are in the past have been evicted for occurrences that arose through actions their abuser took against them. And so the idea that that would remain on CCAP for that long and stop them from being able to access housing later on is really concerning. We've been told that provision is going to change, so we hope that it will. But there are other provisions in the bill, like allowing landlords to submit inaccurate notices as part of eviction court filings. So this would actually make it legal for landlords to submit court filings that have the wrong dollar amount as far as what the tenant owes. But that would be legal for them to submit that in eviction court filings. So it limits the access to hearings in eviction cases by requiring tenants to prove to a court commissioner that they have a valid legal claim. It also lets landlords sort of pick and choose how they want to enforce lease terms. So currently, if you have a change to your lease that isn't officially written down in the lease, but let's say you're on disability, and so your disability check comes on the 1st or the 2nd, and your landlord has always said you can pay on the 5th, that's totally fine, and you've been paying that way for years. Under this bill, if a landlord decided, you know what, for whatever reason, I want to go back to the 1st, your rent is late, I can file an eviction notice against you. That would be legal, which it is not currently. So there's all sorts of changes like this. Like I said, it's a huge bill. It's 25 pages long, and we have not seen sort of a long process as far as how this bill is moving through the legislature. It's been very quick. We haven't been given much time at all to read through the language and provide testimony to the legislators. At the hearing last week, we were basically told that we were going to get a whole new version of the bill that we still haven't seen. So this is very concerning, particularly in a legislative session where we've seen a broad focus on homelessness. We've seen a strong bipartisan approach to dealing with homelessness in our state, and we applaud those efforts. So it's a little ironic to see all this work on homelessness, but then here's this bill that erodes tenants' rights and makes it easier to evict. Well, when we're talking about domestic violence, if you're going to get evicted because, the court can't slow down eviction proceedings, what happens? It's homelessness. So it's very concerning. And like I said, a little bit ironic to see all this homelessness prevention work while at the same time this bill that's very damaging for survivors.
The case from sponsors of the legislation, I think from landlord advocates, is it is hard to evict people. It's a long process now. The longer it takes to evict someone basically is the longer we're renting an apartment, a house for free. That ultimately is going to drive up costs for everyone.
Yeah, I mean, I understand the concern there, but I think when we're talking about access to housing and affordable housing, we're not asking to move the earth so that tenants can do whatever they want. What we're asking for is that tenants have basic rights, basic protections, particularly for vulnerable folks and low-income tenants and victims of domestic violence. Folks like in these situations, they need basic protections, basic rights, and they need stability. And they need to know that if they're facing eviction from problems that are no fault of their own, that the courts, the landlords, the whole process is going to reflect those issues, is going to take a nuanced approach to dealing with these problems. That's what we're asking for here. We're not trying to give tenants, leeway to do whatever they want and to pay rent whenever they want. We're talking about basic rights here for tenants, and we're talking about, frankly, the dignity of people like domestic violence victims who should not be evicted, in a from after 5 days of waiting for emergency funds because they and their kids are in a crisis situation.
Chase, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob. Really appreciate it.
That's Chase Terrier, Public Policy Coordinator for End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin. He joined us to tell us why a new landlord-tenant bill could put domestic abuse victims at a higher risk for eviction. First, the term food desert became a hot-button topic in talk about equal access to fresh, healthy foods. A food desert is an area, often urban or rural, where accessing healthy, fresh food options is difficult. But according to new research, the bigger problem might be food swamps, places with too many unhealthy food options. Olga Kazan is a staff writer at The Atlantic covering gender, health, and science. Welcome back to Central Time, Olga.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Well, this idea of food deserts as a health hazard, the idea was, okay, people don't have access to healthy food, and that is leading to a rise in obesity. There have been studies on this. What are people finding out?
Yeah, so it's basically kind of a mixed relationship. Some studies show that, yes, living far from a grocery store is associated with obesity. Other studies, say they put a grocery store into a community and looked at what happened, and basically people's weight or their health didn't really change at all. So we can't necessarily say, oh, yes, food deserts are the cause of obesity. If only we fixed that, people would be less obese. So that's kind of where the complication comes from.
Obesity is just one marker of health. Is it possible that, okay, people are not losing weight with that grocery store nearby, but they're eating more fruits and veggies, which is going to be a good thing?
Yeah, absolutely. And some of the studies on food swamps have shown that people's dietary habits change, but some of them actually showed that they didn't buy more fruits and veggies either. And of course, weight loss takes a really long time and is not always feasible for people. So you can't necessarily say that just because someone didn't lose weight, in the two-month study period or whatever, that it didn't work.
Now, you wrote about this idea, this phrase that was, I got to admit, new to me. I'd heard of food deserts. I had not heard of this idea of food swamps. What do we mean by that?
Swamps is sort of this new term that researchers are looking at to see, okay, in addition to there not being enough grocery stores in an area, could it be that having too many fast food places and kind of convenience stores and other places that don't sell fresh produce or really any kind of healthy food, could that be contributing to the problems of obesity in some of these communities? So what this recent study that came out in November found is that actually over and above not having a grocery store in your environment, what's really kind of problematic and what can lead to obesity is living in a food swamp where, let's say, you do have food choices, you do have food options in your neighborhood, but they're all really bad for you. It's all, kind of fast food places or the corner store where you can buy chips and soda. So that's where the food swamps come from, and so people now think that that might be kind of a stronger predictor of obesity rates.
And then how do we start to measure what kind of impact that has on obesity, this ratio, this high ratio of unhealthy food options to healthy stuff?
Yeah, well, so this one study kind of went and counted up all the fast food restaurants and groceries and convenience stores and compared it to the number of grocery stores and supermarkets. And then there was like another study that was done a few years ago that looked at just the number of supermarkets nearby versus just the number of fast food places nearby. So there definitely needs to be more research on this and kind of more examination of how exactly it affects people. But essentially, it's unfortunately like everything in nutrition, a really long process.
And this is a food story. This is also a transportation story. You write in your piece that another wrinkle in this is this a neighborhood where maybe people don't own a lot of cars and have limited public transportation options? So the stuff in their neighborhood is the stuff they have to eat.
Right, exactly. So the relationship between the food swamps and obesity is stronger when people don't have cars and there's not good public transportation in the area. Some of the reasons why the food desert research didn't show an impact on obesity is because sometimes, you can just hop in your car and, say, drive 20 minutes. It's not always convenient, but you can get to the big supermarket and load up your car kind of for the week, and then you have it. But if you don't have that car, if you can't really make those big, shopping trips and get everything you need, then you are reliant on the convenience store around the corner, which is not going to have, lettuce and tomatoes. It's going to have, chips and soda.
Olga Kazan is with us from The Atlantic talking about this idea of food swamps as a possible driver of obesity in American neighborhoods. That's places where there's lots of access to fast food, convenience foods, not so much to the healthy stuff, the fresh produce. Olga, suppose this checks out and we find, okay, yeah, these food swamps, that is a big deal. That's a big part of the problem. What do we do with that? How can we change that setting?
Yeah, so it's really difficult. It's really hard to get the fast food restaurants that are open to shut down. That's like part of kind of business and capitalism, is that you can't just make businesses close. You could try zoning where you, in a certain city or community, you could make it so that it's hard for these so-called formula restaurants to open. These are like, you know, chain restaurants, essentially. And so a few kind of cities, I think in California, have looked at this and possibly even done it. But actually, the zoning can sometimes backfire. Los Angeles tried to ban new fast food restaurants in a low-income part of the city in 2008, but it didn't actually decrease obesity rates at all. So zoning doesn't necessarily always work in order to fix these food swamps.
Now, a personal observation, I don't think you mentioned this in the piece, but I have seen around Wisconsin, in urban and rural areas, places where the convenience stores or drug stores or other places have some fresh fruit and some veggies. Is that a thought, maybe, that if we can get these places, or fast food restaurants have salads now for that matter, that, okay, if we can work with these places that sell unhealthy stuff to get more healthy options in the places that already exist?
Yeah, and that's one thing that a lot of cities are looking at, is trying to get, and not just looking at, a lot of cities are doing this now. I know D.C. is, I'm not sure how many others are, but they will, there's actually, you know, initiatives at the local level to get more fresh produce into corner stores and convenience stores, because it is so hard to attract a whole new, you know, supermarket into an area, especially if there's very little space in that area, and there's not a lot of income coming into that area. So, yeah, that is definitely, is just how do we get the you know, the good stuff into the places that are already there, is something people are looking at. It just takes a long time to roll that out on a national scale, and also a really long time to change people's behavior so that they start, you know, looking at the little produce corner of the corner store instead of the chips aisle.
And on a wider note, I mean, this is kind of a different way of thinking about obesity. I think in our daily lives, we think about it as the personal choice I make about what to eat and the exercise to get. This is looking at it in a public health way and also a community and city planning way.
Yeah, this is definitely, I mean, I think what people are realizing, at least at the public health level, is that, you know, it would be kind of a stretch to attribute all of obesity to personal choices. The obesity epidemic is now so widespread, and it has grown so rapidly, that I think we have to start looking at our built environment and our food environment that could be contributing to it. Because even if you have the personal choice, and let's say you can ride the bus for an hour, and you can get to that supermarket, and you can buy the vegetables, but then you have to go home and cook them, and you might have, you know, not have the time, you might not have the money. You have to look at, like, how you're being nudged into making less healthy choices.
And do we see, I mean, you mentioned that attempt in LA to solve the problem by zoning that didn't pan out. Are you seeing other local or state efforts to do something, whatever that something might be?
Yeah, I mean, so California, like I mentioned, has done some of these bans, and they were, I don't know if they studied obesity rates in those areas, but some cities are considering taxing soda, seeing soda as kind of, you know, the most problematic of these junk foods that are on offer in food swamps. They actually kind of drive up the price of it so that, almost like cigarettes, people will be less tempted to buy it. There's a lot of different kind of ideas out there that people are experimenting with. So we unfortunately just need a lot more time and research to figure out what exactly is going to work.
A lot of what we've been talking about applies to urban areas, but people have pointed toward rural deserts, food deserts in rural areas too, as maybe that grocery store in the small town closes, you've got to go two towns over to find a large store, you're down to that gas station convenience store. Are people paying attention to this in rural America?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think definitely, and I've reported in some rural places that definitely qualify as food swamps and food deserts. I think maybe one difference in some of those areas is that people might have cars, because they rely on cars every day to get, you know, wherever they work. Absolutely, this is an issue that affects, you know, both cities and rural areas.
And Olga, big picture again, I mean, We've seen the obesity rates go up in America. Are you seeing any signs that we're plateauing or turning the trend around?
No, not that I've seen. I think they're pretty much still still pretty bad and still going up. And actually is might be part of the explanation for why American life expectancy has started to go down as well.
We'll leave it there for now. Olga, thanks a lot for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
We'll talk to Olga Hazan. She's a staff writer at The Atlantic. She joined us today to talk about this idea of food swaps, areas often in urban and in rural America where there's more junk food, more unhealthy food available than healthy food. Love to hear from you about this. You can email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR. Is this what's going on where you live? Do you wish you had more healthy food options where you are? Or has something changed maybe for the better? A new store opened up that gives you more access to fruits and vegetables where you are. Email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us @CentralTimeWPR. Coming up in a speech yesterday, President Trump talked about his goals for rural America. We'll talk about what rural parts of our nation and Wisconsin need to help strengthen rural economies. By the way, you can download the Wisconsin Public Radio app to bring these discussions with you wherever you go. Listen on your phone or tablet or whatever device you're carrying these days. Go to whichever version of the app obtaining website you get, Google Play or the App Store, and download the WPR app and follow us and let us follow you everywhere. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Now, President Trump's visit to Tennessee on Monday focused on rural America with a speech before a Farm Bureau convention and the signing of executive orders aimed at expanding broadband access in rural America. Lack of reliable high-speed internet is just one of many factors at play in limited rural economic growth. Federal policies such as immigration reform and overall spending can also have major impacts on rural economies. Tessa Conroy is an economic development specialist at the University of Wisconsin Extension Center for Community and Economic Development and an assistant professor in the UW-Madison Department of Applied and Agricultural Economics. Tessa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Well, let's look at the economic recovery in rural America, rural Wisconsin in particular. Slower than in, say, urban America, right?
Definitely. When you look at rural America or rural Wisconsin job growth compared to the urban areas, it has been slower. And I think part of that has to do with the different industrial composition in rural places relative to urban places. We have more agriculture, more farming, more manufacturing, a larger public sector. And in particular, agriculture and manufacturing have gotten leaner, that you can do more with fewer people, so they're just not adding the jobs that they used to.
So automation is part of that story in manufacturing, and I imagine in agriculture as well?
Potentially, I think so, that we, again, doing more with less people, we've become more productive, but that means potentially less employment.
And you said farming and manufacturing. I think sometimes when we think rural, what pops into our head is a lot of farms, but farming is not the whole story when it comes to rural economies.
Exactly. When we think about a rural economy, they're really pretty diverse. Farming as a source of income is only about 5% in rural Wisconsin. So things like manufacturing, like the public sector, matter a lot as well.
And let's get into some of what the president had talked about. And let's start with access to broadband, to high-speed internet in rural areas. This is an issue that people have been talking about in Wisconsin a lot. We hear from our listeners in rural and even closer to cities sometimes than you might think, saying this is a limit on the quality of life in the economy. What do you make of the role of broadband access?
I do think broadband is a weak spot in rural Wisconsin. That makes it kind of harder for businesses to operate and also less desirable place to live. I think a lot of people, especially maybe in the kind of 20 to 34 age group, they want to be able to get Netflix. They want to be able to connect to their employers. So having good internet service is kind of part of what they're looking for. for, I think, from a quality of life perspective.
So is that something that limits economic growth significantly?
I don't know how significant the factor is in terms of what the constraints are. I think that some of the other issues that are also facing rural America should be considered alongside broadband.
And then the president also highlighted the recently passed federal tax law and tax cuts, saying, hey, this is going to help farmers in particular. What are some of the tax needs for people in rural areas?
That is difficult for me to say. I think that surely there will, you know, likely be some short-term benefits, how long those last. There was some notes about the estate tax in particular for farmers being a good thing. What I've read and what I've seen says that a relatively small portion of farms are actually going to be affected by that change in the estate tax. So we'll have to wait and see.
And I want to get into a couple other issues and issues that have been big for candidate Donald Trump and President Donald Trump, trade and immigration. The president spoke out against a lot of current and potential international trade deals. There's a renegotiation of NAFTA with Canada and Mexico going on right now. This is a huge, complicated question, but what on balance are farmers looking at when it comes to trade agreements?
I think in particular with NAFTA that Canada and Mexico are really important trade partners for agriculture. So the idea of potentially losing those or even the uncertainty that could come with a change in the agreement could provoke some anxiety among our agricultural producers. With immigration, I think that for agriculture that, you know, with limited access to labor, that these immigrant pools of labor have become really important. And to the extent that, you know, where the administration is signaling a shift in policy, that that's adding additional uncertainty to kind of where are we going to get our labor, and not only kind of where are we going to get it, but how much is it going to cost? And that could mean shifting more towards automation potentially. There's some point at which labor becomes expensive and you have to start thinking about alternative methods.
We're talking to Tessa Conroy from the UW Extension Center for Community and Economic Development about the rural economy in Wisconsin and around the nation after President Trump talked to a Farm Bureau group about his rural priorities. Tessa, you've written in the past about entrepreneurship in rural Wisconsin. What do we see out there?
I would say rural Wisconsin is surprisingly entrepreneurial, that rural Wisconsin compared to our urban areas, our metro areas, we have higher rates of proprietorship. So that's signals at least one kind of self-employed person. We also see higher rates of business survival. And I think that part of that speaks to just the resourcefulness of rural economies. I think some people are self-employed in rural areas because they have to be. And so there's a certain kind of stick-with-itness that comes with a rural economy and that those potential, that entrepreneurial potential is really there.
I think given how our pop culture works and our media coverage, people think entrepreneurship and startups and are thinking high-tech Silicon Valley company. Also, that might be the proprietor of a farm business. It might be an independent contractor who puts up their shingle as a business person.
Definitely. Agriculture, in a lot of ways, is one of the more entrepreneurial occupations that we have. But on the whole, farms are about one-sixth of our proprietors. So there's still, again, speaking to the rural economy, there's a lot more going on out there. And we can think about a diverse rural economy.
Are there policy changes that might help those entrepreneurs in different sectors in rural Wisconsin?
I do think the broadband is part of it because a lot of our self-employed folks are not employers. They're potentially working from home. So connecting to suppliers, connecting to customers does require internet. So I think that's encouraging.
And you've also talked about the impact of public spending and public employment in rural areas. How does that play out?
The public sector generally is a larger source of earnings in rural areas, closer to 20% relative to, say, closer to 15% in urban places. So what that means is that in rural areas, and I think that you see it when you drive through, the schools, the road department, the post offices are these really important employers in rural areas. So rural areas are going to be sensitive to changes in government spending. They're going to be probably felt more so than in a large, you know, more diverse economy like the Milwaukee area.
So with schools in particular, I mean, that could be a significant employer in a small town. We hear talk sometimes of a district consolidation. That could be a real economic blow and community blow to a small community if they lose that school.
I think so. I think a community to be attractive, to draw new residents, things like having a school, having some healthcare services are really important. So once you lose your schools, that becomes a really major challenge.
Looking at the printed statement from the White House, one issue they raise is transportation in rural areas. We've talked about this on Central Time before. When you think public transportation, you think a city and buses or some kind of fixed rail thing. There are a lot of transportation challenges facing rural areas as well. Can you talk about those?
I think that in particular, what comes to mind is that some employers in rural areas are having to draw from pretty large areas to get the employees that they need. So that means their workers are driving quite some distance. So that can be expensive. You need a high quality car. You need to be able to afford the trip. So it can make getting to work a little bit more difficult. It can kind of reduce the incentive should the, you know, you have to compare the wages to the cost of getting there.
And another issue, again, on that White House statement was healthcare access. And we've talked to state lawmakers from both parties on the show in the past, talking about how this can be a real quality of life and economic issue in small communities if they don't have access to physical healthcare, mental healthcare, in some cases addiction treatment. How big a factor is that?
I think it is an important factor. I think that the limited availability of healthcare services, of mental healthcare services in rural areas is definitely a factor. I think that there are some kind of innovative things happening in terms of people being able to get care kind of through the phone, able to connect with providers and that kind of thing. But again, kind of like the schools, these are basic kind of quality of life questions that we need to address in rural America.
And I keep, every now and then I'll see a chart from a state or a community showing who the big employers are over time. And healthcare providers keep creeping up those lists. So how big a part of a job sector is healthcare in rural Wisconsin?
In general, we kind of lump education and healthcare together oftentimes, and this is kind of one of the biggest sectors. But that's true across the state. That's not just rural Wisconsin. That's true in urban areas as well.
We're talking to Tessa Conroy, Economic Development Specialist at the UW Extension Center for Community and Economic Development. She's also an assistant professor at the UW-Madison Department of Applied and Agricultural Economics. She's with us to talk about policy issues affecting rural America and rural Wisconsin. We want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. Are you in rural Wisconsin? What do you think about some of the issues we've been talking about? What are the barriers, you think, to economic success for your community, for your household, for that matter, in rural Wisconsin? What do you need? Is it the rural broadband that we've heard a lot of bipartisan talk about at the state and federal level? Are there transportation issues? Do you have access to health care? Call in at 800-642-1234. And if you're a farmer, of course, the president talked to a Farm Bureau group. What are you looking for from the federal government, from the new farm bill that is up for negotiation? It's a big, complicated document. Call in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about how federal policy can affect rural parts of the country and rural parts of Wisconsin. Yesterday, President Trump addressed the American Farm Bureau and made the case for a number of reforms he'd like to see to help rural areas, including signing a bill aimed at better high-speed internet access in rural America. Tessa Conroy is with us from the UW Extension Center for Community and Economic Development, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you are in a rural area, a small town, what are the challenges your community is facing with the long, slow recovery from the Great Recession? Have you recovered in your area? If not, what do you need? What could the federal government do to help, the state government, businesses? What successes have you had? Is this rural broadband issue important to you? Is this a problem for your area, for your style of life, for your community? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Why don't we just briefly touch on the immigration issue, Tessa? And you mentioned that a lot of agricultural enterprises and others are dependent on immigrants. What happens, especially with farms, if that is slowed down, if they don't have access to that immigrant labor?
I think part of it is the affordability issue. So we have to be able to get affordable labor, so kind of quantity and quality. And if we have to raise wages to do that, that kind of changes the calculus of production. You start thinking about the point, when is this becoming expensive enough that I need to consider automating or a different method of production and reduce the need for labor altogether? And I think that, you know, we're starting to see those pressures creep in on our farmers and production agriculture.
Let's go to our call. Oh, sorry. Let's go to our callers at 800-642-1234. Dennis is on the line in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi. When I was doing research work for a local research company, some things that people complain about in the rural areas is the local clinics and sometimes hospitals are pretty much just a place to go get a bandage. So if you combine broadband access and medical care, when a specialist in a place where, like, say, Madison or Milwaukee ward, can say to a physician's assistant or a nurse practitioner, hey, this is what this person needs, this is what you need to do to treat that person, that can be the combination right there to get specialized care in a far-off place.
Dennis, thanks a lot for the call. So remote medicine in a way, and I usually think of that as the patient directly contacting the provider, but that's an interesting, you know, having that hot online consult between the local provider and the specialist in the city.
Yeah, it's an interesting overlap of issues and potentially a solution as well in rural areas. You know, that connectivity can help alleviate some of those kind of local needs for healthcare.
Thanks for that call. We'll go next to Kelly on the line in Cascade. Kelly, hi.
My family, my husband and two kids, and I moved back to Wisconsin from the Pacific Northwest with an interest in opening up a farm-to-table kind of cooking school. We chose Wisconsin because it just seemed like farm prices were cheaper, Milwaukee had a lot going on in the foodie industry. I've been pretty shocked at just the contrast in rural Washington State. It just seemed like there was a lot more going on in the rural communities, more progressive kinds of things. Here, we had to chop down a tree to get internet access, and that was kind of shocking. We called out like four or five different providers, and nobody could get access to the cell tower, and finally they said you have to cut down that beautiful tree if you want internet access. We chose to be here, so we're dealing with all of those things. I feel like we're kind of on the frontier of trying to be a part of a wave of hopeful change here. Just very different compared to what we've come from.
Kelly, thanks a lot for calling and sharing your experience. So this is maybe a place where Wisconsin is lagging compared to at least Washington, Kelly says, Tessa.
I think your experience speaks to the challenge of rural broadband and kind of rural internet service in that it's a high cost, low density problem. So making that appealing to internet service providers is a challenge. So I think that we have to figure out ways to get around that.
And Kelly brings up another issue we've heard some about for that farm entrepreneur. It isn't necessarily just we're going to grow lots of a commodity and sell it. We're going to have some kind of specialized service, value-added service, whether farm-to-table in this case. We've heard of agritourism, value-added products, like, you know, canning your goods and selling them at markets. How big a part of the story is that?
I think that there is growing interest in kind of boutique farms and local foods and organic farming. I think that some of those farms are facing some higher costs and they have a challenge in distribution. They're going to need more than their local farmers market to make that profitable. But I'm interested to see how that particular sector evolves.
Kelly, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking about the economic situation, economic needs in rural Wisconsin, rural America, after President Trump spoke to a farm group yesterday about his goals for rural America. Tessa Conroy with us from UW Extension and the UW Madison. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Peter is with us in Madison. Peter, hi.
Hi. I think expanding broadband to rural parts of the state and rural parts of the country would be a great way for Democrats to win a lot of votes of people who have given up on the Democratic Party. And I really hope that they do it. If you look at the New Deal, FDR, he expanded electricity to rural parts of the country where it was not economically viable, but the government subsidized it because they understood it was part of living, that having electricity. I think in our day and age, having access to the internet is extremely important. And it would be a good strategy for the Democrats to win more voters in rural areas.
Peter? Peter, thanks for the call. And we've seen, of course, a Republican president and Republicans here in Wisconsin highlight the issue. It's not going to be necessarily cheap to do this, is it, Tessa? These are remote areas. It's not apparently profitable for companies to lay those internet tubes, as people call them, the lines to get there.
Right. So I think thinking about what incentives are going to be necessary to get service out there, whether that's, I don't know, what would be the public investment or what it would take to make it profitable for service providers. But I do think that that's one of the challenges.
Thanks for the call, Peter. We go next to Kim on the line in Sun Prairie. Kim, hi.
Hello there. And actually, I am on the road between Tacoma, Wisconsin, and Sun Prairie. It's an hour and a half drive I make every morning and every evening. To my work position. I am a psychiatric nurse practitioner who is moving to a rural area in order to provide some mental health care for an underserved population.
Wow. So how you're working with an agency in that rural area, how did you get hooked up with that?
They were recruiting me pretty hard, as is everybody else is recruiting for psych providers in Wisconsin. There aren't very many of us.
And are you're going to move out of Sun Prairie to there, is that right?
Yep, I have a daughter who's a senior in high school, and I'm not going to pull her out too early.
Gotcha. Kim, thank you so much for sharing that experience. And we hear with whether it's healthcare providers, teachers, some other positions, kind of a competition for rural areas to try to lure people like Kim to work there.
Right. So I think thinking about the desirability of these rural communities and what we can do to make them desirable places to live and really think about the quality of life issues is going to be important for getting the type of workers we need.
Thanks, and congratulations on the impending graduation, too. We'll go next to Kristen on the line in Daggett, Michigan. Kristen, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about?
Well, thanks for taking my call. And I don't want it to be too much of a personal story, but it is. I worked in the mental health field for many years. I live on the border of the UP of Michigan and Wisconsin. And I recently have had to seek some professional help for myself. And it took me 9 months to get in to see a psychiatrist in this area after being released from an inpatient facility for depression. And I guess some of the services where I live come out of the state of Wisconsin. That's why I feel it's appropriate for your show. I don't understand why the government hasn't figured that out yet, that's a terrible burden on people who live in rural areas to try to seek professional help.
Kristen, thanks a lot for the call. And we've heard efforts from lawmakers, at least proposals, for a lot of different kinds of professionals, lawyers, mental health providers, others, to come up with maybe tuition-related incentives to get them to provide services in these areas.
Yeah, I think there's an opportunity to think about what kind of recruitment mechanisms or incentive structures would be appropriate. But beyond that, I think people are really looking for a desirable place to live. So again, coming back to that placemaking and thinking about what makes rural Wisconsin and these rural communities who do really have a lot of strengths, what can make them desirable places to live.
Kristen, thanks for that call. And Tessa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Tessa Conroy, Economic Development Specialist at the UW Extension Center for Community and Economic Development. She is an assistant professor in the UW-Madison's Department of Applied and Agricultural Economics. Joins us to talk about President Trump's speech to the American Farm Bureau Federation and about the economic needs of rural America and rural Wisconsin in particular.